All right, going on with the next half of the chapter. Now war rose in heaven, Michael and his angels fighting against the dragon. And the dragon and his angels fought back. And they were defeated. And there was no longer any place for them in heaven. And the great dragon was thrown down, the ancient serpent, who is called the devil and Satan. So at this point, it's pretty clear who the that dragon is, right? He was thrown down to the earth, and his angels were thrown down with him. And I heard a loud voice in heaven saying, "Now salvation and power in the kingdom of our God and the authority of his Christ have come. For the accuser of our brothers has been thrown down, who accuses them day and night before our God. And they have conquered him by the blood of the Lamb." Okay. Verse 13, "And when the dragon saw that he had been thrown down to earth, he pursued the woman who had given birth to the male child." So we're back to the woman. All right? So that's not over. "But the woman was given wings of a great eagle so that she might fly from the serpent into the wilderness to where she to be nourished for a time, a times, and half a time." Times. Oh, that's terrible. Times, time, half a time. Okay? Are these related?
Yes.
Okay. "The serpent poured water like a river out of her mouth after the woman to sweep her away with a flood. The earth came to the help of the woman, and the earth opened its mouth and swallowed the river. Then the dragon became furious with the woman and went off to make war on the rest of her offspring, on those who keep the commandments of God and who hold to the testimony of Jesus. And he stood on the sand of the sea." Now, the offspring, whoever the woman is, the offspring is obviously Christians, right? They are the ones who keep the commandments of God and hold the testimony of Jesus. And Satan, at this point, is about to wage war. Now, it ends here with, where is he standing? He stood on the sand of the sea. All right, let's not let the chapter break stand in our way and look to see what happens. "And I saw a beast rising out of the sea." All right? That doesn't seem too coincidental. "With 10 horns and 7 heads." There's that 10 and 7 again. Okay? 10 horns, 7 heads, just like the dragon. And it describes the beast there. "And the beast was given a mouth uttering haughty and blasphemous words, and it was allowed," this is verse 5, "to exercise authority for 42 months. We'll just stick with 42. So there's a first beast, and then there's a second beast there. And then in chapter 14, we get to the Lamb and the 144,000, which is, of course, going back to the seals. All right? All right, so that's essentially where we're going. There's not a lot of sevens. There's a few sevens in here, but not a lot of sevens. There's the seventh trumpet, and there's the seven related to the beast and the dragon. But that's not the controlling number within this section. Now, with those numbers in mind, let's go find all of those instances. Okay? If we look at Revelation 11:2, "But do not measure the court outside the temple. Leave that out, for it was given to the nations, and they will trample the holy city for 42 months. All right? So there's one. 42 months. In 11:3, "The witnesses are to witness for 1,260 days. That's 11:3. Then in 11:9, "They are dead for 3.5 days. Okay? Then the woman in 12:6, look at 12:6. "The woman fled into the wilderness where she has a place prepared by God in which she is to be nourished for 1,260 days. 12:4, we had times a time and a half of time, 12:14. "But the woman was given 2 wings of the great eagle so that she might fly from the serpent into the wilderness to the place where she is to be nourished for a time and a times and a half of time." And then 13:5, once again, And the beast was given a mouth, uttering haughty and blasphemous words, and was allowed to exercise authority for 42 months. All right. First of all, let's talk about the connection between these numbers, and then see if we can figure out where these possibly come from. Okay. Let's talk about this first of all. These two. How's 3.5 connected to times time and a half a time?
Times equals 2.
Times is 2. Time is 1. Half a time, 3.5. So these are definitely referring, right? Some numerically, they're basically pointing to the same thing, which is really interesting. Okay. Now, what do these two numbers have to do with each other?
1,260 divided by 30 is 42.
Okay, that is correct. Now, why is that important?
Number of months.
And so, if you've got 42 months, that is actually equal to 1,262 days. Now, 42 months is how many years?
3.5.
Okay. So that's how they ultimately all fit together. They're all 1,260 days. Now, which is kind of, it's probably not a coincidence. Now, the question is after this, is how are they trying to link them together, right? Now, sometimes it's days, like 3.5 days with the dead, with the dead witnesses, all right? Not 3.5 years, 3.5 days. All right, but the numbers, it's too much to be a coincidence, I think, for all of these to be similar. Now, let's start with some Old Testament references. Now, first of all, the woman in chapter 12, where does she hide? In the wilderness. Okay, this is totally a weird one. Go to Numbers 33. There's absolutely no way I would have even thought to turn here until somebody pointed this out. Numbers 33. Now, Numbers. Right. This is basically taking place at the end of the of what period of time? While Israel is where? In the wilderness, right? Wandering around in the wilderness. In the wilderness before they go into the promised land. If you count the places they stop, take a wild guess what number you come up with. I'll give you
42.
One. 42. Good job. Now, how many years were they in the wilderness? 40 years. Or 42 years. What if this is a round number? 40 rounded up for 42. It's interesting. Now, the woman, when you go to Revelation, I think what's probably obvious to everyone, except someone who really is bent on a literal interpretation of everything, is these numbers are probably symbolic of something. I think most of us would probably go ahead and assume that. What if, just throwing this out there, this is not a coincidence, and at this point 40 or 42 became symbolic of something. And this is how they thought of when they saw the number 42. What did they think? They thought about Israel in the wilderness. Now there is one book, the book of Daniel, that does, and go ahead and turn there, have a lot of numbers in it. So go to Daniel chapter 7. And so as you're thinking about these chapters, you should think of at least Daniel 9, 7, 9, and 12. We'll start in Daniel chapter 7. Daniel chapter 7, verse 1. In the first year of Belshazzar, king of Babylon, Daniel saw a dream and visions of his head as he lay in his bed. Then he wrote down the dream and told the sum of the matter. All right, so it's a dream, it's a vision. All of Daniel's other dreams were highly symbolic. We would expect to see that here. Daniel declared, I saw in my vision by night, and behold, the four winds of heaven were stirring up the great sea, probably referring to the Mediterranean, and four great beasts came out of the sea, different from one another, which should make you think of Revelation in terms of a beast coming out of the sea. Now, you've got this description of the four beasts here at the beginning of chapter 7. Then in chapter 7, 9, you've got, and as I looked, thrones were placed, and the Ancient of Days took his seat. His clothing was white as snow, and the hair of his head like pure wool. His throne was fiery flames, its wheels were burning fire. A stream of fire issued and came out from before him. A thousand of thousands served him, and 10,000 times 10,000 stood before him. The court sat in judgment, and the books were opened. So we have the Ancient of Days, vision of God. The books were opened. We were in court. In verse 13, and behold, the clouds of heaven, there came one like a son of man. He came to the Ancient of Days and was presented before him, and to him was given dominion and glory and a kingdom. All right? And of course, as we all know, Jesus quotes this and says, this is me. Right? So we know who this is. At the time of Daniel, Daniel probably didn't know who this was. But it's really clear later on, as Jesus says, well, this is me. In verse 19, now, Daniel is rather concerned about the fourth beast, because the fourth beast was super powerful. In Daniel 7:19, I desired to know the truth about the fourth beast, which is different from all the rest, exceedingly terrifying, and with its teeth of iron and claws of bronze, and with devoured and broken pieces and stamped what was left with its feet. And about the 10 horns, that sounds interesting, 10 horns that were on its head, and the other horn that came up, and before which 3 of them fell, the horn that had eyes and a mouth that spoke great things that seemed greater than its companion. And I looked, and this horn made war with the saints and prevailed over them. All right, think of perhaps the witnesses, perhaps. Until the Ancient of Days came, and judgment was given for the saints of the Most High, and the time came when the saints possessed the kingdom. Thus he said, as for the fourth beast, there shall be a fourth kingdom on the earth, which shall be different from all the kingdoms, and it shall devour the whole earth, trample it down, and break it into pieces. As for the 10 horns, out of this kingdom 10 kings shall arise, another shall arise after them. He shall be different from the former ones, and shall put down 3 kings. He shall speak words against the Most High, and shall wear out the saints of the Most High, and shall think to change the times and the law, and they shall be given into his hand for a time, a times, and half a time. There's our 3.5, once again. But the court shall sit in judgment, and his dominion shall be taken away after 3.5 something. And the kingdom and the dominion of the greatness of the kingdoms over the whole earth shall be given to the kingdom of the saints of the Most High. His kingdom shall be an everlasting kingdom, and all dominions shall serve and obey him. Okay. Now turn to Daniel chapter 9. Daniel is praying about the people, praying for the people. Gabriel, in verse 20, comes to bring an answer. In verse 24, we have some interesting things. 70 weeks are decreed about your people and your holy city to finish the transgression, to put an end to sin, and to atone for iniquity, to bring in everlasting righteousness, and to seal both vision and prophet, and to anoint a most holy place. Know therefore and understand that from the going out of the word to restore and build Jerusalem, to the coming of an anointed one, a prince, there shall be 7 weeks. Then for 62 weeks it shall be built again with squares and moat, but in a troubled time. And after the 62 weeks, an anointed one shall be cut off and shall have nothing. And the people of the prince who is to come shall destroy the city and the sanctuary. Its end shall come with a flood. And to the end there shall be war. Desolations are decreed. And he shall make a strong covenant with many for 1 week. And for half of the week he shall put an end to sacrifice and offering. And on the wing of abominations shall come one who makes desolate until the decreed end is poured out on the desolator. What's half of 7?
3.5.
Math. I don't even like math. Joking, math's great. Daniel 12. We've already looked at this one. And I heard the man clothed in linen who was above the waters of the stream. He raised his right hand and his left hand toward heaven and swore by him who lives forever that it would be for a time and a times and a half a time that when the shattering of the power of the holy people comes to an end and all these things would be finished. Is this talking about the first half or the second half of what's going on in Revelation chapter 12? Or is it something that's entirely different? It's a good question, I think. Okay. Yes.
Do we know the exact numbers that goes with times, half a time? Or?
Well, in Daniel, you've got the 70 weeks of years. Okay? You've got that essentially referred to in Daniel. 70 weeks. 70 weeks is how many days? If there's 70 weeks of years, this is how many years? Right? 490 years, right? What's 490 years? All right, what's 490 years before AD 70? Or what's 490 years before the death of Jesus? And so this is going to be, if it's AD 70, you've got 420 years, right? Because 490 minus 70 is 420. Okay? If we're talking about the death of Jesus, then you take roughly 30 years out, and we're looking at 460 BC. Okay? And so when you've got these weeks of years, he's talking about after the coming of a prince and essentially a rebuilding happens, some great things are going to happen. So in other words, what Daniel's trying to do with his numerology, all right, in terms of the 490, do we know how long the 490 is supposed to last? Actually, it fits awfully well with the 490 weeks of years actually pointing directly to the time of Jesus' death and resurrection and at least the end of it, to just about AD 70. And so Daniel, symbolically, seems to be laying out a roadmap. Now, in terms of these numbers, all right, are these numbers meant to be exact? I don't know. Like, for example, the dispensationalists would take the 7 years time for the end time is actually very specific in terms of a time frame, and that it is exactly a 7 year period of time that this stuff goes on in the book of Revelation. Most people tend to take a lot of these numbers as symbolic. But the reason I bring this up, and the reason why we've read portions of all of these, and I've referenced this, we'll go look at it in a second and reference that, is all of this provides background ideas to what's going on in Revelation. Revelation is not written in a vacuum. There's a whole world of ideas and a world of numbers, right? Daniel was very important to them, okay? when Jesus, all right, when Jesus says, and you're going to see the Son of Man coming in clouds, right? Jesus is putting a very high level of importance on Daniel's prophecy at that point in terms of understanding what's going on with him, right? You're going to kill me. You're going to see me coming back on the clouds, okay? Which, on the Olivet Discourse, Jesus says these things will happen within that generation. So there's a mixture of symbolism. But it's not just symbolism meant to point at nothing in particular. It's just ideas. Some of it, at least with Daniel, you could see as actually pointing towards actual events. And so when you got the book of Revelation, right? We discussed this last time, time before last, where you compared Daniel 12 with the book of Revelation and the time frame. The book of Daniel was like, when is this going to happen? It's a while. There's like four kingdoms to come. All right? Not this one, not that one, not the next one, but the one after that. That's when this is all going to go down. Okay? When all of that's done. What was the kingdom when Daniel started prophesying? It was in the reign of Belshazzar. Nebuchadnezzar was whenever he was taken into captivity, right? So that would be Babylon. Okay. What was the kingdom after the Babylonians?
Persians.
All right. Cyrus. Cyrus the Great comes in, defeats Babylon, becomes the next world power. Who defeated the Persians?
Rome.
Nope.
Greece.
Actually, it was the Persians conquered the Medes. And so the Medo-Persian Empire is generally how people look at that. Alexander.
Greek.
Right? Now, the Assyrians are before Babylon. By the time Daniel is prophesying, the Assyrians are gone. Babylon has already taken them out. Alexander the Great comes next, and his when he died, his empire broke up. Who took over the empire of Alexander the Great and beat all of his generals? Rome. Because his generals were basically all fighting it out until Rome took over the world. And so, who is this great beast that has come and that is super powerful and crushes everything in its path? The great beast that does that in Revelation, excuse me, in Daniel, is Rome. So we have a specific time frame in terms of how this is all supposed to play out. Now, from Daniel, did he know they were the Romans?
No.
No, he would know nothing about them, right? Because all he knows is they're super powerful. At some point, right, at the beginning, he wouldn't even know with the Medo-Persians, though he would live into their conquest and be active as a prophet in chapter 12 was during the Medo-Persian Empire. But he would not know at the beginning about these guys, and he never saw Alexander the Great. He was dead for quite a while before. Alexander, who is the great ram who comes from the west, another one of the prophecies of Daniel, and takes out the Persians. Here's your four kingdoms that appear.
Dead? Are the four beasts symbolic of four kingdoms?
They are.
Fourth is the worst. Rome is the worst of those four.
Vicious, powerful. That definitely describes Rome. Unstoppable, generally speaking. Generally speaking, they were stopped sometimes. But very, very powerful, right? And evil. Now, this all goes to the Jewish worldview, right? These are not secular nation states. They did not view things as secular nation states. Okay? Nation states didn't exist at this time. What you've got is you've got individuals and cities taking control and essentially those cities ruling. All right? Rome, right, was this one. The individual, obviously, was Alexander the Great in this case. And for the Persians, it was the king of Persia. And who runs the world? Whoever happens to be the king of Persia at the time. They're pretty much running. Who's controlling Jerusalem? It just entirely depends. It's usually not the Jews. All right. There's a short period of time between Jewish independence between Alexander and Rome. But when Rome comes, they're subsumed. And so when you think about Revelation, and I know we go to Old Testament a lot, and so this is not different than anything else we've done so far, but you've got to keep these things in mind. All right, these Daniel references, we're going to have to come back to these multiple times, I expect. Ezekiel, we looked at Ezekiel at the very beginning, where we talked about a lot of the narrative of Ezekiel was controlling the whole narrative of the book of Revelation. We will have to come back to that more. And, of course, Zechariah 4, which we haven't really discussed. So let's look at that, and this is where we'll dismiss for the day. So Zechariah chapter 4. We've looked at Zechariah before in the study, so this is not our first time to come here. Now, to remind you why we're coming here, we're talking about the witnesses in Revelation chapter 11. These are two olive trees and the two lampstands that stand before the Lord of the earth. If anyone would harm them, fire pours out of their mouth and consumes their foes. Two lampstands, two olive trees. Zechariah chapter 4. And so Zechariah is having a vision. In chapter 3, there was a discussion of Joshua. There's two main characters in the book of Zechariah, other than Zechariah himself and God. That would be Joshua, the priest, and Zerubbabel, the guy who was supposed to rule as kingly regent. Chapter 4, the angel who talked with me came again and woke me like a man who was awakened out of his sleep. And he said to me, "What do you see?" I said, "I see, and behold, a lampstand all of gold with a bowl on the top of it, and seven lamps on it." Think of seven lamps in Revelation. "With seven lips on each of the lamps that are on top of it. And there are two olive trees beside it, one on the right of the bowl and the other on the left." All right, let's talk about the connection between olive trees and lamps. Elliot, you're in a dark room. You say, "I need some light." Someone hands you a light bulb. What do you say? Correct. Right? A light bulb by itself is not going to do anything, right? It's got to have electricity, right? It's not going to show any light. A light bulb without electricity is really just no good at all. Okay. All right. Where do we go from here? Okay. Let's take this now to where I think you'll understand where I'm going with this. I know some of the youth here have never used lamps. Okay? Because we were talking about this the other day in terms of... I was talking to Jonathan. He wasn't sure what kerosene was. Old people, like myself, have used kerosene lamps, right? It's not really something most people use today because we have these big batteries and bright lights, right? What good is a flashlight without its batteries? What good is a kerosene lamp without kerosene? If you've got a gas stove and you don't have a propane tank, well, you can put wood on top of the gas stove and set it on fire, but that's not the same thing, right? Lamps, all right, lamps without some form of fuel are how useful? You could use them as violent weapons, but in terms of providing light, they're not particularly useful. What about the parable of those with the lamps? What was the problem? Some of them didn't have enough
oil.
What kind of oil did they have? They didn't have petroleum. They weren't digging and processing oil. Petroleum, they were processing olive oil, right? And so when you think of lampstands for them, they would have immediately had an idea that would come in their head, just like light bulbs are useless without electricity. What good is a lamp unless you have a way of putting fuel in the lamp? You got to have lamps, but you got to have olive trees, because without the olive trees, the lamps are useless. So back here in Zechariah chapter 4, that's why they're both here. Okay? You've got a lampstand, which is useless unless it's got olive trees. And if you have an olive trees and your lamps, how much fuel do you have? Essentially, endless fuel. Okay, that's the idea. So there's the connection. And there are two olive trees beside it, by it, one on the right of the bowl and one on the left. And the angel who talked with me, and I said to the angel who talked with me, "What are these, my Lord?" Then the angel who talked with me answered and said to me, so in other words, if you don't know what this is referring to, it's okay. Neither did Zechariah. "Do you not know what these are?" I said, "No, my Lord." Then he said to me, "This is the word of the Lord to Zerubbabel, not my might nor by power, but by my spirit, says the Lord of hosts. Who are you, O great mountain? Before Zerubbabel you shall become a plain, and he shall bring forward the top stone, and amid shouts of grace, grace to it." Okay? Verse 8, "Then the word of the Lord came to me, saying," and this is pretty important, "the hands of Zerubbabel have laid the foundations of this house. His hands shall also complete it." What house is this? This will tell you something about the time frame. Or if you know the time frame, it'll tell you exactly what house it is. What's our time frame from Zechariah? What's that? Okay, so if it's 519 BC, what house is it that needs a foundation? Somebody say it. What house needs a foundation?
The temple.
The temple. When was the temple destroyed?
587.
They have no temple. And that's actually one of the big problems in some of the later prophets. All right? One of the big problems is they go back to the land, right? Cyrus says, everybody go home. Go back to your land, worship your gods. The Jews go back, and do they immediately build the temple and resume the worship of Yahweh? No, actually, there's a lot of problems. And what the book of Zechariah is about here is talking about Zerubbabel and trying to encourage Zerubbabel and Joshua as leaders of the people to rebuild the temple. That's one of the major issues in the later prophets. And so you've got here something, it's not just Zerubbabel and the high priest, you've got priest and king, but you've also got something related to the temple and reestablishing the true worship of the God of Israel. And then people trying to get in the way. Why would John in Revelation be referencing that? It's a good question. I don't want you to think about it, and that's what we'll discuss. So, as we're going forward, okay, I want you to go back. I want you to read the last half of Daniel a few times. Read all of Zechariah. It's not that long. Right? And going and reviewing Ezekiel some will be good. We don't need really to spend much time in Ezekiel right now, but we will soon. But right here, this should be your Old Testament focus as we're thinking about where we are in Revelation. Okay? And think about those numbers. Are they trying to say all of these things are happening at the same time? Even though we have what seems to be a progression in the book of Revelation, are these actually one big thing that should be laid on top of each other? Depends on the way you take these things. All right. So these are the kind of questions we're going to be asking. What do these numbers mean? Because they're a different set of numbers. We're out of the sevens. We're now into whatever that combination is supposed to refer to. Okay. Any questions, thoughts? Other than, what does it mean? There's lots of questions to be answered here. And I don't have all the answers. All right? So no questions. Thoughts? Okay. Well, think about these things. All right? Think about them. If you don't come up with an answer, it's okay. But do your best. Realize, see these echoes of the Old Testament. Pray about it. Think about it. Okay. No thoughts or questions then. Okay. Jonathan, will you pray for us, please?